5 minutes after her arrival, Robin set a mug of steaming dark brown Thai foo in front of Strike, who gave her a thumbs up and a silent thanks. She returned to her desk, where a light was flashing on the phone to indicate a recorded message. She dialed their answering service and listened, while a cool female voice informed her that the call had been made 10 minutes before Robin had arrived, and presumably while Strike was either upstairs or busy with the other call. A cracked whisper hissed in Robin's ear.
"I'm sorry I ran out on you, Mr. Strike. I'm sorry. I can't come back, though. He's keeping me here. I can't get out. He's wired the doors."
The end of the sentence was lost in sobs. Worried, Robin tried to attract Strike's attention, but he had turned in his swivel chair to look out of the window, still listening to his mobile. Random words reached Robin through the pitiable sounds of distress on the phone.
"Can't get out. I'm all alone."
"Yeah, okay," Strike was saying in his office. "Wednesday, then, okay? Great. Have a good one."
"Please help me, Mr. Strike,"
wailed the voice in Robin's ear. She smacked the button to switch the speakerphone, and at once the tortured voice filled the office.
"The doors will explode if I try and escape, Mr. Strike. Please help me. Please come and help me. I shouldn't have come. I told him I know about the little kid, and he's bigger, much bigger. I thought I could trust him."
Strike spun in his desk chair, got up, and came striding through to the outer office. There was a clunk, as though the receiver had been dropped. The sobbing continued at a distance, as though the distraught speaker was stumbling away from the phone.
"That's him again," said Strike. "Billy. Billy Knight."
The sobbing and gasping grew louder again, and Billy said in a frantic whisper, his lips evidently pressed against the mouthpiece,
"There's someone at the door. Help me. Help me, Mr. Strike."
The call was cut. "Get the number," said Strike. Robin reached for the receiver to dial 1471, but before she could do so, the phone rang again. She snatched it up, her eyes on Strike's. "Cormoran Strike's office."
"Ah, yes, good morning," said a deep, patrician voice.
Robin grimaced at Strike and shook her head.
"Shit," he muttered,
and moved back into his office to get his tea.
"I'd like to speak to Mr. Strike, please."
"I'm afraid he's on another call right now," lied Robin. Their standard practice for a year had been to phone the client back. It weeded out journalists and cranks.
"I'll hold," said the caller, who sounded captious, unused to not getting his way.
"He'll be a while, I'm afraid. Could I take a number and get him to call you back?"
"Well, it needs to be within the next 10 minutes, because I'm about to go into a meeting. Tell him I want to discuss a job I'd like him to do for me."
"I'm afraid I can't guarantee that Mr. Strike will be able to undertake the job in person," said Robin,
which was also the standard response to deflect press. "Our agency's quite booked up at the moment." She pulled pen and paper towards her.
"What kind of job are you—"
"It has to be Mr. Strike," said the voice firmly. "Make that clear to him. It has to be Mr. Strike himself. My name's Chisel."
"How are you spelling that?"
asked Robin, wondering whether she had heard correctly.
"C-H-I-S-W-E-L-L. Jasper Chisel. Ask him to call me on the following number."
Robin copied down the digits Chisel gave her and bade him good morning. As she set down the receiver, Strike sat down on the fake leather sofa they kept in the outer room for clients. It had a disobliging habit of making unexpected farting noises when you shifted position.
"A man called Jasper Chisel, spelt Chiswell, wants you to take on a job for him. He says it's got to be you, nobody else."
Robin screwed up her forehead in perplexity.
"I know the name, don't I?"
"Yeah," said Strike. "He's Minister for Culture."
"Oh, my God," said Robin, realization dawning. "Of course, the big man with the weird hair."
"That's him."
A clutch of vague memories and associations assailed Robin. She seemed to remember an old affair, resignation and disgrace, rehabilitation, and somewhat more recently, a fresh scandal, another nasty news story. "Didn't his son get sent to jail for manslaughter not that long ago?" she said. "That was Chisel, wasn't it? His son was stoned and driving, and he killed a young mother." Strike recalled his attention, it seemed, from a distance. He was wearing a peculiar expression.
"Yeah, that rings a bell," said Strike.
"What's the matter?"
"A few things, actually," said Strike, running a hand over his stubbly chin. "For starters, I tracked down Billy's brother on Friday."
"How?"
"Long story," said Strike. "But turns out Jimmy's part of a group that's protesting against the Olympics. Corps, they call themselves. Anyway, he was with a girl, and the first thing she said when I told him I was a private detective was, 'Chisels sent him.'"
Strike pondered this point while drinking his perfectly brewed tea.
"But Chisel wouldn't need me to keep an eye on Corps," he went on, thinking aloud. "There was already a plainclothes guy there."
Though keen to hear what other things troubled Strike about Chisel's call, Robin did not prompt him, but sat in silence, allowing him to mull the new development. It was precisely this kind of tack that Strike had missed when she was out of the office.
"And get this," he went on at last, as though there had been no interruption. "The son who went to jail for manslaughter isn't, or wasn't, Chisel's only boy. His eldest was called Freddy, and he died in Basra. Yeah, Major Freddy Chisel, Queen's Royal Hussars, killed in an attack on a convoy. I investigated his death in action when I was still SIB.
"So you know Chisel?"
"No, never met him. You don't meet families, usually. I knew Chisel's daughter years ago as well, only slightly. But I met her a few times. She was an old school friend of Charlotte's."
Robin experienced a tiny frisson at the mention of Charlotte. She had a great curiosity, which she successfully concealed, about Charlotte, the woman Strike had been involved with on and off for 16 years, whom he had been supposed to marry before the relationship ended messily and apparently permanently.
"Pity we couldn't get Billy's number," said Strike, running a large, hairy-backed hand over his jaw again.
"I'll make sure I get it if he calls again," Robin assured him. "Are you going to ring Chisel back? He said he was about to go into a meeting."
"I'm keen to find out what he wants, but the question is whether we've got room for another client," said Strike. "Let's think."
He put his hands behind his head, frowning up at the ceiling, on which many fine cracks were exposed by the sunlight.
"Screw that now. The office would soon be a developer's problem after all. I've got Andy and Barclay watching the Webster kid. Barclay's doing well, by the way. I've had 3 solid days surveillance out of him, pictures the lot. Then there's old dodgy Doc. He still hasn't done anything newsworthy."
"Shame," said Robin. Then she caught herself. "No, I don't mean that. I mean good." She rubbed her eyes. "This job," she sighed, "it messes with your ethics. Who's watching Dodgy today?"
"I was going to ask you to do it," said Strike. "But the client called yesterday afternoon. He'd forgotten to tell me Dodgy's at a symposium in Paris."
Eyes still on the ceiling, brow furrowed in thought, Strike said,
"We've got 2 days at that tech conference starting tomorrow. Which do you want to do? Harley Street or a conference centre out in Epping Forest? We can swap over if you want. Do you want to spend tomorrow watching Dodgy, or with hundreds of stinking geeks in superhero T-shirts?"
"Not all tech people smell," Robin reprimanded him. "Your mate Spanner doesn't."
"You don't want to judge Spanner by the amount of deodorant he puts on to come here," said Strike.
Spanner, who had overhauled their computer and telephone system when the business had received its dramatic boost in business, was the younger brother of Strike's old friend Nick. He fancied Robin, and she and Strike were equally aware. Strike mulled over options, rubbing his chin again.
"I'll call Chisel back and find out what he's after," he said at last. "You never know, it might be a bigger job than that lawyer whose wife's sleeping around. He's next on the waiting list, right?"
"Him or that American woman who's married to the Ferrari dealer. They're both waiting." Strike sighed. Infidelity formed the bulk of their workload.
I hope Chisel's wife isn't cheating. I fancy a change.
The sofa made its usual flatulent noises as Strike quit it. As he strode back to the inner office, Robin called after him. Are you happy for me to finish up this paperwork, then?
If you don't mind, said Strike, closing the door behind him.
Robin turned back to her computer, feeling quite cheerful. A busker had just started singing No Woman, No Cry in Denmark Street, and for a while there, while they talked about Billy Knight and the Chisels, she had felt as though they were the Strike and Robin of a year ago, before he had sacked her, before she had married Matthew. Meanwhile, in the inner office, Strike's call to Jasper Chisel had been answered almost instantly.
"Chisel!" he barked. "Cormoran Strike here," said the detective. "You spoke to my partner a short while ago." "Ah, yes," said the Minister for Culture, who sounded as though he were in the back of a car. "I've got a job for you. Nothing I want to discuss over the phone. I'm busy today and this evening, unfortunately, but tomorrow would suit."
"Ob observing the hypocrites," sang the busker down in the street.
"Sorry, no chance tomorrow," said Strike, watching motes of dust fall through the bright sunlight. "No chance until Friday, actually. Can you give me an idea what kind of job we're talking about, Minister?"
Chisel's response was both tense and angry.
"I can't discuss it over the phone. I'll make it worth your while to meet me, if that's what you want." "It isn't a question of money, it's time. I'm solidly booked until Friday." "Oh, for Christ's sake!"
Chisel suddenly removed his phone from his mouth, and Strike heard him talking furiously to somebody else.
"Left here, you moron! Left, for fuck's sake! Now I'll walk! I'll bloody walk! Open the door!"
In the background, Strike heard a nervous man say, "I'm sorry, Minister, it was no entry.
Never mind that. Open this bloody door."
Strike waited, eyebrows raised. He heard a car door slam, rapid footsteps, and then Jasper Chisel spoke again, his mouth close to the receiver.
"The job's urgent," he hissed.
"If it can't wait until Friday, you'll have to find someone else, I'm afraid."
"My feet is my only carriage," sang the busker. Chisel said nothing for a few seconds, then, finally,
"It's got to be you. I'll explain when we meet, but..." "All right, if it has to be Friday, meet me at Pratt's Club, Park Place. Come at 12. I'll give you lunch."
"All right,"
Strike agreed, now thoroughly intrigued.
"See you at Pratt's."
He hung up and returned to the office where Robin was opening and sorting mail. When he told her the upshot of the conversation, she Googled Pratt's for him.
"I didn't think places like this still existed," she said in disbelief, after a minute's reading off the monitor.
"Places like what?"
"It's a gentleman's club. Very Tory, no women allowed except as guests of club members at lunchtime. And, to avoid confusion," Robin read from the Wikipedia page, "all male staff members are called George."
"What if they hire a woman?"
"Apparently they did in the '80s," said Robin, her expression midway between amusement and disapproval. "They called her Georgina."
Chapter 9. It's best for you not to know. Best for us both. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. At 11:30 the following Friday, a suited and freshly shaven Strike emerged from Green Park Tube Station and proceeded along Piccadilly. Double-deckers rolled past the windows of luxury shops, which were capitalizing on Olympics fever to push an eclectic mix of goods. Gold-wrapped chocolate medals, Union Jack brogues, antique sporting posters, and over and again, the jagged logo that Jimmy Knight had compared to a broken swastika. Strike had allowed a generous margin of time to reach Pratt's, because his leg was again aching after 2 days in which he had rarely been able to take the weight of his prosthesis. He had hoped that the tech conference in Epping Forest, where he had spent the previous day, might have offered intervals of rest, but he had been disappointed. His target, the recently fired partner of a start-up, was suspected of trying to sell key features of their new app to competitors. For hours, Strike had tailed the young man from booth to booth, documenting all his movements and his interactions, hoping at some point that he would tire and sit. However, between the coffee bar where customers stood at high tables, to the sandwich bar where everyone stood and ate sushi with their fingers out of plastic boxes, the target had spent 8 hours walking or standing. Coming after long hours of lurking in Harley Street the day before, it was hardly surprising that the removal of his prosthesis the previous evening had been an uncomfortable affair, the gel pad that separated stump from artificial shin difficult to prise off. As Strike passed the cool off-white arches of the Ritz, he hoped Pratt's contained at least one comfortable chair of generous proportions. He turned right into St. James's Street, which led him in a gentle slope straight down to the 16th-century St. James's Palace. This was not an area of London that Strike usually visited on his own account, given that he had neither the means nor the inclination to buy from gentlemen's outfitters, long-established gun shops, or centuries-old wine dealers. As he drew nearer to Park Place, though, he was visited by a personal memory. He had walked this street more than 10 years previously, with Charlotte. They had walked up the slope, not down it, heading for a lunch date with her father, who was now dead. Strike had been on leave from the army, and they had recently resumed what was, to everyone who knew them, an incomprehensible and obviously doomed affair. On neither side of their relationship had there ever been a single supporter. His friends and family had viewed Charlotte with everything from mistrust to loathing, while hers had always considered Strike, the illegitimate son of an infamous rock star, as one more manifestation of Charlotte's need to shock and rebel. Strike's military career had been nothing to her family, or rather, it had been just another sign of his plebeian unfitness to aspire to the well-bred beauty's hand, because gentlemen of Charlotte's class did not enter the military police, but cavalry or guards regiments. She had clutched his hand very tightly as they entered an Italian restaurant somewhere nearby. Its precise location escaped Strike now. All he remembered was the expression of rage and disapproval on Sir Anthony Campbell's face as they had approached the table. Strike had known before a word was spoken that Charlotte had not told her father that she and Strike had resumed their affair, or that she would be bringing him with her. It had been a thoroughly Charlottean omission, prompting the usual Charlottean scene. Strike had long since come to believe that she engineered situations out of an apparently insatiable need for conflict. Prone to outbursts of lacerating honesty amid her general mythomania, she had told Strike towards the end of their relationship that at least, while fighting, she knew she was alive. As Strike drew level with Park Place, a line of cream-painted townhouses leading off St. James's Street, he noted that the sudden memory of Charlotte clinging to his hand no longer hurt, and felt like an alcoholic who for the first time catches a whiff of beer without breaking into a sweat or having to grapple with his desperate craving. "Perhaps this is it," he thought, as he approached the black door of Pratt's with its wrought-iron balustrade above. Perhaps, 2 years after she had told him the unforgivable lie and he had left for good, he was healed, clear of what he sometimes, even though not superstitious, saw as a kind of Bermuda Triangle, a danger zone in which he feared being pulled back under, dragged to the depths of anguish and pain by the mysterious allure Charlotte had held for him. With a faint sense of celebration, Strike knocked on the door of Pratt's. A petite, motherly woman opened up. Her prominent bust and alert, bright-eyed mien put him in mind of a robin or a wren. When she spoke, he caught a trace of the West Country. "You'll be Mr. Strike. The minister's not here yet. Come along in." He followed her across the threshold into a hall through which could be glimpsed an enormous billiard table. Rich crimsons, greens, and dark wood predominated. The stewardess, who he assumed was Georgina, led him down a set of steep stairs, which Strike took carefully, maintaining a firm grip on the banister. The stairs led to a cosy basement. The ceiling had sunk so low that it appeared partially supported by a large dresser on which sundry porcelain platters were displayed, the topmost ones half embedded into the plaster. "We aren't very big," she said, stating the obvious. 600 members, but we can only serve 14 a meal at a time. Would you like a drink, Mr. Strike?" He declined, but accepted an invitation to sit down in one of the leather chairs grouped around an aged cribbage board. The small space was divided by an archway into sitting and dining areas. Two places had been set at the long table in the other half of the room, beneath small shuttered windows. The only other person in the basement, apart from himself and Georgina, was a white-coated chef, working in a minuscule kitchen a mere yard from where Strike sat. The chef bade Strike welcome in a French accent, then continued carving cold roast beef. Here was the very antithesis of the smart restaurants where Strike tailed errant husbands and wives, where the lighting was chosen to complement glass and granite, and sharp-tongued restaurant critics sat like stylish vultures on uncomfortable modern chairs. Pratt's was dimly lit. Brass picture lights dotted walls papered in dark red, which was largely obscured by stuffed fish in glass cases, hunting prints, and political cartoons. In a blue and white tiled niche along one side of the room sat an ancient iron stove. The china plates, the threadbare carpet, the table bearing its homely load of ketchup and mustard, all contributed to an ambience of cosy informality, as though a bunch of aristocratic boys had dragged all the things they liked about the grown-up world, its games, its drink, and its trophies, down into the basement, where Nanny would dole out smiles, comfort, and praise. 12 o'clock arrived, but Chisel did not. Georgina, however, was friendly and informative about the club. She and her husband, the chef, lived on the premises. Strike could not help but reflect that this must be some of the most expensive real estate in London. To maintain the little club, which, Georgina told him, had been established in 1857, was costing somebody a lot of money. "The Duke of Devonshire owns it, yes," said Georgina brightly. "Have you seen our betting book?" Strike turned the pages of the heavy, leather-bound tome, where long ago wages had been recorded. In a gigantic scrawl dating back to the 70s, he read, "Mrs. Thatcher to form the next government. Bet, one lobster dinner. The lobster to be larger than a man's erect cock." He was grinning over this when a bell rang overhead. "That'll be the minister," said Georgina, bustling away upstairs. Strike replaced the betting book on its shelf and returned to his seat. From overhead came heavy footsteps, and then, descending the stairs, the same irascible, impatient voice he had heard on Monday. "No, Kinbara, I can't. I've just told you why. I've got a lunch meeting." "No, you can't. 5 o'clock, then. Yes, yes, yes. Goodbye." A pair of large, black-shod feet descended the stairs until Jasper Chisel emerged into the basement, peering around with a truculent air. Strike rose from his armchair. "Ah," said Chisel, scrutinizing Strike from beneath his heavy eyebrows. "You're here." Jasper Chisel wore his 68 years reasonably well. A big, broad man, though round-shouldered, he still had a full head of grey hair, which, implausible though it seemed, was his own. This hair made Chisel an easy target for cartoonists, because it was coarse, straight, and rather long, standing out from his head in a manner that suggested a wig, or, so the unkind suggested, a chimney brush. To the hair was added a large red face, small eyes, and a protuberant lower lip, which gave him the air of an overgrown baby perpetually on the verge of a tantrum.
"My wife," he told Strike, brandishing the mobile still in his hand. "Come up to town without warning, sulking. Thinks I can drop everything."
Chisel stretched out a large sweaty hand, which Strike shook, then eased off the heavy overcoat he was wearing despite the heat of the day. As he did so, Strike noticed the pin on his frayed regimental tie. The uninitiated might think it a rocking horse, but Strike recognized it at once as the White Horse of Hanover.
"Queen's Own Hussars," said Strike, nodding at it as both men sat down. "Yes," said Chisel.
"Georgina, I'll have some of that sherry you gave me when I was in with Alistair. You?"
he barked at Strike.
"No thanks."
Though nowhere near as dirty as Billy Knight, Chisel did not smell very fresh.
"Yes. Queen's Own Hussars, Aden and Singapore. Happy days."
He didn't seem happy at the moment. His ruddy skin had an odd plaque-like appearance close up. Dandruff lay thick in the roots of his coarse hair, and large patches of sweat spread around the underarms of his blue shirt. The minister bore the unmistakable appearance, not unusual in Strike's clients, of a man under intense strain, and when his sherry arrived, he swallowed most of it in a single gulp.
"Shall we move through?" he suggested,
and without waiting for an answer he barked,
"We'll eat straight away, Georgina."
Once they were seated at the table, which had a stiff, snowy white tablecloth like those at Robin's wedding, Georgina brought them thick slices of cold roast beef and boiled potatoes. It was English nursery food, plain and unfussy, and none the worse for it. Only when the stewardess had left them in peace, in the dim dining room full of oil paintings and more dead fish, did Chisel speak again.
"You were at Jimmy Knight's meeting," he said, without preamble. "A plainclothes officer there recognized you."
Strike nodded. Chisel shoved a boiled potato in his mouth, masticated angrily, and swallowed before saying,
"I don't know who's paying you to get dirt on Jimmy Knight, or what you may already have on him, but whoever it is and whatever you've got, I'm prepared to pay double for the information." "I haven't got anything on Jimmy Knight, I'm afraid," said Strike. "Nobody was paying me to be at the meeting."
Chisel looked stunned.
"But then why were you there?" he demanded. "You're not telling me you intend to protest against the Olympics."
So plosive was the pea of protest that a small piece of potato flew out of his mouth across the table.
"No," said Strike. "I was trying to find somebody I thought might be at the meeting. They weren't."
Chisel attacked his beef again, as though it had personally wronged him. For a while, the only sounds were those of their knives and forks scraping the china. Chisel speared the last of his boiled potatoes, put it whole into his mouth, let his knife and fork fall with a clatter onto his plate, and said,
"I'd been thinking of hiring a detective before I heard you were watching Knight."
Strike said nothing. Chisel eyed him suspiciously.
"You have the reputation of being very good."
"Kind of you to say so," said Strike.
Chisel continued to glare at Strike with a kind of furious desperation, as though wondering whether he dared hope that the detective would not prove yet another disappointment in a life beset with them.
"I'm being blackmailed, Mr. Strike," he said abruptly.
"Blackmailed by a pair of men who have come together in a temporary, though probably unstable, alliance. One of them is Jimmy Knight."
"I see," said Strike.
He too put his knife and fork together. Georgina appeared to know by some psychic process that Strike and Chisel had eaten their fill of the main course. She arrived to clear away, reappearing with a treacle tart. Only once she had retired to the kitchen, and both men had helped themselves to large slices of pudding, did Chisel resume his story.
"There's no need for sordid details," he said, with an air of finality. "All you need to know is that Jimmy Knight is aware that I did something that I would not wish to see shared with the gentleman of the Fourth Estate."
Strike said nothing. But Chisel seemed to think his silence had an accusatory flavour, because he added sharply,
"No crime was committed. Some might not like it, but it wasn't illegal at the... But that's by the by," said Chisel, and took a large gulp of water. "Knight came to me a couple of months ago and asked for £40,000 in hush money. I refused to pay. He threatened me with exposure, but as he didn't appear to have any proof of his claim, I dared hope he would be unable to follow through on the threat. No press story resulted, so I concluded that I was right in thinking he had no proof. He returned a few weeks later and asked for half the former sum. Again, I refused. It was then, thinking to increase the pressure on me, I assume, that he approached Geraint Wynne. I'm sorry, I don't know who. Della Wynne's husband."
"Della Wynne, the Minister for Sport?"
said Strike, startled.
"Yes, of course, Della Wynne, the Minister for Sport,"
snapped Chisel. The Right Honourable Della Wynne, as Strike knew well, was a Welshwoman in her early 60s who had been blind since birth. No matter their party affiliation, people tended to admire the Liberal Democrat, who had been a human rights lawyer before standing for Parliament. Usually photographed with her guide dog, a pale yellow Labrador, she had been much in evidence in the press of late, her current bailiwick being the Paralympics. She had visited Selly Oak while Strike had been in the hospital, readjusting to the loss of his leg in Afghanistan. He had been left with a favourable impression of her intelligence and her empathy. Of her husband, Strike knew nothing.
"I don't know whether Della knows what Geraint's up to," said Chisel,
spearing a piece of treacle tart and continuing to speak while he chewed it.
"Probably, but keeping her nose clean. Plausible deniability. Can't have the sainted Della involved in blackmail, can we?"
"Her husband's asked you for money?" asked Strike, incredulous.
"Oh, no, no. Geraint wants to force me from office."
"Any particular reason why?" said Strike.
"There's an enmity between us dating back many years, rooted in a wholly baseless..." "But that's irrelevant," said Chisel, with an angry shake of the head. "Geraint approached me, hoping it isn't true and offering me a chance to explain. He's a nasty, twisted little man who spent his life holding his wife's handbag and answering her telephone calls. Naturally, he's relishing the idea of wielding some actual power."
Chisel took a swig of sherry.
"So, as you can see, I'm in something of a cleft stick, Mr. Strike. Even if I were minded to pay off Jimmy Knight, I still have to contend with a man who wants my disgrace and who may well be able to lay hands on proof."
"How could Wynne get proof?"
Chisel took another large mouthful of treacle tart and glanced over his shoulder to check that Georgina remained safely in the kitchen.
"I've heard," he muttered,
and a fine mist of pastry flew from the slack lips,
"that there may be photographs."
"Photographs," repeated Strike. "Wynne can't have them, of course. If he had, it would be all over. But he might be able to find a way of getting hold of them, yes."
He shoved the last piece of tart into his mouth, then said,
"Of course, there's a chance the photographs don't incriminate me. There are no distinguishing marks, so far as I'm aware."
Strike's imagination frankly boggled. He yearned to ask, "Distinguishing marks on what, Minister?" but refrained.
"It all happened 6 years ago," continued Chisel. "I've been over and over the damn thing in my head. There were others involved who might have talked, but I doubt it. I doubt it very much. Too much to lose. No, it's all going to come down to what Knight and Wynne can dig up. I strongly suspect that if he gets hold of the photographs, Wynne will go straight to the press. I don't think that would be Knight's first choice. He simply wants money. So here I am, Mr. Strike. Affronte praecipitium atergo lupi. I've lived with this hanging over me for weeks now. It hasn't been enjoyable."
He peered at Strike through his tiny eyes, and the detective was irresistibly put in mind of a mole blinking up at a hovering spade that waited to crush it.
"When I heard you were at that meeting, I assumed you were investigating Knight and had some dirt on him. I've come to the conclusion that the only way out of this diabolical situation is to find something that I can use against each of them before they get their hands on those photographs. Fight fire with fire."
"Blackmail with blackmail," said Strike.
"I don't want anything from them except to leave me the hell alone," snapped Chisel. "Bargaining chips, that's all I want. I acted within the law," he said firmly, "and in accordance with my conscience."
Chisel was not a particularly likable man, but Strike could well imagine that the ongoing suspense of waiting for public exposure would be torture, especially to a man who had already endured his fair share of scandals. Strike's scant research on his prospective client the previous evening had unearthed gleeful accounts of the affair that had ended his first marriage, of the fact that his second wife had spent a week in a clinic for nervous exhaustion, and of the grisly drug-induced car crash in which his younger son had killed a young mother.
"This is a very big job, Mr. Chisel," said Strike. "It'll take two or three people to thoroughly investigate Knight and Wynne, especially if there is time pressure. I don't care what it costs, said Chisel. I don't care if you have to put your whole agency on it. I refuse to believe there isn't anything dodgy about Wynne, sneaking little toad that he is. There's something funny about them as a couple. She, the blind angel of light, Chisel's lips curled, and he, her pot-bellied henchman, always scheming and backstabbing and grubbing up every freebie he can get. There must be something there, must be. As for Knight, commie rabble-rouser, there's bound to be something the police haven't yet caught up with. He was always a tearaway, a thoroughly nasty piece of work. You knew Jimmy Knight before he started trying to blackmail you? Asked Strike. Oh, yes, said Chisel. The Knights are from my constituency. The father was an odd-job man who did a certain amount of work for our family. I never knew the mother. I believe she died before the three of them moved into Stedder Cottage. I see, said Strike. He was recalling Billy's anguished words. I seen a child strangled and nobody believes me. The nervous movement from nose to chest as he made his slipshod half-cross, and the prosaic, precise detail of the pink blanket in which the dead child had been buried. "There's something I think I should tell you before we discuss terms, Mr. Chisel," said Strike. "I was at the core meeting because I was trying to find Knight's younger brother. His name's Billy." The crease between Chisel's myopic eyes deepened a fraction. "Yes, I remember that there were two of them. But Jimmy was the elder by a considerable amount, a decade or more, I would guess. I haven't seen Billy, is it, in many years." "Well, he's seriously mentally ill," said Strike. "He came to me last Monday with a peculiar story, then bolted." Chisel waited, and Strike was sure he detected tension. "Billy claims," said Strike, "that he witnessed the strangling of a small child when he was very young." Chisel did not recoil, horrified. He did not bluster or storm. He did not demand whether he was being accused or ask what on earth that had to do with him. He responded with none of the flamboyant defences of the guilty man, and yet Strike could have sworn that to Chisel this was not a new story.
"And who does he claim strangled the child?" he asked, fingering the stem of his wine glass. "He didn't tell me, or wouldn't." "You think this is what Knight is blackmailing me over? Infanticide?" asked Chisel roughly. "I thought you ought to know why I went looking for Jimmy," said Strike. "I have no deaths on my conscience," said Jasper Chisel forcefully. He swallowed the last of his water. "One cannot," he added, replacing the empty glass on the table, "be held accountable for unintended consequences."
Chapter 10. I have believed that we two together would be equal to it. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. The detective and the minister emerged from 14 Park Place an hour later and walked the few yards that took them back to St. James's Street. Chisel had become less curmudgeonly and gnomic over coffee, relieved, Strike suspected, to have put in train some action that might lift from him what had clearly become an almost intolerable burden of dread and suspense. They had agreed terms, and Strike was pleased with the deal, because this promised to be a better paid and more challenging job than the agency had been given in a while.
"Well, thank you, Mr. Strike," said Chisel, staring off down St. James's, as they both paused on the corner. "I must leave you here. I have an appointment with my son."
Yet he did not move.
"You investigated Freddy's death,"
he said abruptly, glancing at Strike out of the corner of his eyes. Strike had not expected Chisel to raise the subject, and especially not here, as an afterthought, after the intensity of their basement discussion.
"Yes," he replied. "I'm sorry."
Chisel's eyes remained fixed on a distant art gallery.
"I remembered your name on the report," said Chisel. "It's an unusual one."
He swallowed, still squinting at the gallery. He seems strangely unwilling to depart for his appointment.
"Wonderful boy, Freddy," he said. "Wonderful. Went into my old regiment. Well, as good as. Queen's Own Hussars, amalgamated with the Queen's Royal Irish back in 93, as you'll know. So it was the Queen's Royal Hussars he joined. Full of promise, full of life. But of course you never knew him." "No," said Strike. Some polite comment seemed necessary. "He was your eldest, wasn't he?" "Of four," said Chisel, nodding. "Two girls." And by his inflection he waved them away, mere females, chaff to wheat. "And this other boy," he added darkly. "He went to jail. Perhaps you saw the newspapers." "No," lied Strike, because he knew what it felt like to have your personal details strewn across the newspapers. It was kindest, if at all credible, to pretend you hadn't read it at all, politest to let people tell their own story.
"Been trouble all his life, Raff," said Chisel. "I got him a job in there."
He pointed a thick finger at the distant gallery window.
"Dropped out of his history of art degree," said Chisel. "Friend of mine owns the place, agreed to take him on. My wife thinks he's a lost cause. He killed a young mother in a car. He was high."
Strike said nothing.
"Well, goodbye," said Chisel,
appearing to come out of a melancholy trance. He offered his sweaty hand once more, which Strike shook, then strode away, bundled up in the thick coat that was so inappropriate on this fine June day. Strike proceeded up St. James's Street in the opposite direction, pulling out his mobile as he went. Robin picked up on the third ring.
"Need to meet you," said Strike without preamble. "We got a new job. A big one."
"Damn," she said. "I'm in Harley Street. I didn't want to bother you, knowing you were with Chisel. But Andy's wife broke her wrist falling off a stepladder. I said I'd cover Dodgy while Andy takes her to hospital."
"Shit. Where's Barclay?"
"Still on Webster."
"Is Dodgy in his consulting room?"
"Yes."
"We'll risk it," said Strike. "He usually goes straight home on Fridays. This is urgent. I need to tell you about it face to face. Can you meet me in the Red Lion in Duke of York Street?"
Having refused all alcohol during his meal with Chisel, Strike fancied a pint rather than returning to the office. If he had stuck out in his suit at the White Horse in East Ham, he was perfectly dressed for Mayfair. And 2 minutes later, he entered the Red Lion in Duke of York Street, a snug Victorian pub whose brass fittings and etched glass reminded him of the Tottenham. Taking a pint of London Pride off to a corner table, he looked up Della Wynne and her husband on his phone and began reading an article about the forthcoming Paralympics, in which Della was extensively quoted.
"Hi,"
said Robin, 25 minutes later, dropping her bag onto the seat opposite him.
"Want a drink?"
he asked.
"I'll get it," said Robin. "Well," she said, rejoining him a couple of minutes later, holding an orange juice.
Strike smiled at her, barely contained impatience.
"What was it all about? What did Chisel want?"
The pub, which comprised only a horseshoe space around a single bar, was already tightly packed with smartly dressed men and women, who had started their weekend early, or, like Strike and Robin, were finishing work over a drink. Lowering his voice, Strike told her what had passed between him and Chisel.
"Oh,"
said Robin blankly, when at last Strike had finished filling her in.
"So we're going to try and get dirt on Della Wynne?"
"On her husband," Strike corrected her. "And Chisel prefers the phrase bargaining chips."
Robin said nothing, but sipped her orange juice.
"Blackmail's illegal, Robin," said Strike, correctly reading her uneasy expression. "Knight's trying to screw 40 grand out of Chisel, and Wynne wants to force him out of his job."
"So he's going to blackmail them back, and we're going to help him do it?"
"We get dirt on people every day," said Strike roughly. "It's a bit late to start getting a conscience about it."
He took a long pull on his pint, annoyed not only by her attitude, but by the fact that he had let his resentment show. She lived with her husband in a desirable sash-windowed house in Albury Street, while he remained in two draughty rooms, from which he might soon be ejected by the redevelopment of the street. The agency had never before been offered a job that gave three people full employment, possibly for months. Strike was not about to apologize for being keen to take it. He was tired, after years of graft, of being plunged back into the red whenever the agency hit a lean patch. He had ambitions for his business that couldn't be achieved without building up a far healthier bank balance. Nevertheless, he felt compelled to defend his position.
"We're like lawyers, Robin. We're on the client side."
"You turned down that investment banker the other day, who wanted to find out where his wife..."
"Because it was bloody obvious he'd do her harm if he found her."
"Well," said Robin, a challenging look in her eye, "what if the thing they found out about Chisel..." But before she could finish her sentence, a tall man in deep conversation with a colleague walked straight into Robin's chair, flinging her forward into the table and knocking over her orange juice.
"Oi!"
barked Strike, as Robin tried to wipe the juice off her sopping dress.
"Fancy apologizing?" "Oh, dear," said the man in a drawl, eyeing the juice-soaked Robin as several people turned to stare. "Did I do that?" "Yes, you bloody did," said Strike, heaving himself up and moving around the table. "And that's not an apology." "Cormoran," said Robin warningly. "Well, I'm sorry," said the man, as though making an enormous concession. But taking in Strike's size, his regret seemed to become more sincere. "Seriously, I do appall bugger off," snarled Strike. "Swap seats," he said to Robin. "Then if some other clumsy tosser walks by, they'll get me, not you."
Half embarrassed, half touched, she picked up her handbag, which was also soaked, and did as he had requested. Strike returned to the table, clutching a fistful of paper napkins, which he handed to her.
"Thanks."
It was difficult to maintain a combative stance, given that he was voluntarily sitting in a chair covered in orange juice to spare her. Still dabbing off the juice, Robin leaned in and said quietly,
"You know what I'm worried about? The thing Billy said."
The thin cotton dress was sticking to her everywhere. Strike kept his gaze resolutely on her eyes.
"I asked Chisel about that."
"Did you?"
"Of course I did. What else was I going to think when he said he was being blackmailed by Billy's brother?"
"And what did he say?"
"He said he had no deaths on his hands, but one cannot be held accountable for unintended consequences."
"What on earth does that mean?"
"I asked. He gave me the hypothetical example of a man dropping a mint on which a small child later choked to death."
"What?"
"Your guess is as good as mine. Billy hasn't called back, I suppose."
Robin shook her head.
"Look, the overwhelming probability is Billy's delusional," said Strike. "When I told Chisel what Billy had said, I didn't get any sense of guilt or fear."
As he said it, he remembered the shadow that had passed over Chisel's face and the impression he had received that the story was not, to Chisel, entirely new.
"So what are they blackmailing Chisel about?" asked Robin.
"Search me," said Strike. "He said it happened 6 years ago, which doesn't fit with Billy's story because he wouldn't have been a little kid 6 years ago. Chisel said some people would think what he did was immoral, but it wasn't illegal. He seemed to be suggesting that it wasn't against the law when he did it, but it is now."
Strike suppressed a yawn. Beer and the heat of the afternoon were making him drowsy. He was due at Lorelei's later.
"So do you trust him?"
Robin asked.
"Do I trust Chisel?" Strike wondered aloud, his eyes on the extravagantly engraved mirror behind Robin. "If I had to bet on it, I'd say he was being truthful with me today because he's desperate. Do I think he's generally trustworthy? Probably no more than anyone else."
"You didn't like him, did you?"
asked Robin, incredulously.
"I've been reading about him."
"And?"
"Pro-hanging, anti-immigration, voted against increasing maternity leave."
She didn't notice Strike's involuntary glance down her figure as she continued. "Banged on about family values, then left his wife for a journalist."
"All right. I wouldn't choose him for a drinking buddy, but there's something slightly pitiable about him. He's lost one son, the other one's just killed a woman."
Well, yes, there you are, said Robin. He advocates locking up petty criminals and throwing away the key. Then his son runs over someone's mother and he pulls out all the stops to get him a short set. She broke off suddenly as a loud female voice said, Robin, how lovely! Sarah Shadlock had entered the pub with two men.
Oh, God, muttered Robin, before she could help herself. Then, more loudly, Sarah, hi!
She would have given much to avoid this encounter. Sarah would be delighted to tell Matthew that she had found Robin and Strike having a tête-à-tête in a Mayfair pub, when she herself had told Matthew by phone only an hour ago that she was alone in Harley Street. Sarah insisted on wiggling around the table to embrace Robin, something the latter was sure she would not have done had she not been with men.
"Darling, what's happened to you? You're all sticky."
She was just a little posher here in Mayfair than anywhere else Robin had met her, and several degrees warmer to Robin.
"Nothing," muttered Robin. "Spilled orange juice, that's all." "Cormoran," she said blithely, swooping in for a kiss on his cheek.
Strike, Robin was pleased to note, sat impassive and did not respond.
"Bit of R&R," said Sarah, embracing them both in her knowing smile.
"Work," said Strike bluntly. Receiving no encouragement to stay, Sarah moved along the bar, taking her colleagues with her.
"I forgot Christie's is round the corner," muttered Robin.
Strike checked his watch. He didn't want to have to wear his suit to Lorelei's, and indeed, it was now stained with orange juice from having taken Robin's seat.
"We need to talk about how we're going to do this job, because it starts tomorrow."
"Okay,"
said Robin with some trepidation, because it had been a long time since she had worked a weekend. Matthew had got used to her coming home.
"It's all right," said Strike, apparently reading her mind. "I won't need you till Monday. The job's going to take three people at a minimum. I reckon we've already got enough on Webster to keep the client happy, so we'll put Andy full-time on Dodgy Dock. Let the two waiting list clients know we're not going to be able to do them this month, and Barclay can come in with us on the Chisel case. On Monday, you're going into the House of Commons."
"And what?" said Robin, startled.
"You're going to go in as Chisel's goddaughter, who's interested in a career in Parliament, and get started on Geraint, who runs Della's constituency office at the other end of the corridor to Chisel's. Chat him up."
He took a swig of beer, frowning at her over the top of the glass.
"What?"
said Robin, unsure what was coming.
"How do you feel?"
said Strike, so quietly that she had to lean in to hear him.
"About breaking the law?"
"Well, I tend to be opposed to it," said Robin, unsure whether to be amused or worried. "That's sort of why I wanted to do investigative work."
"And if the law's a bit of a grey area and we can't get the information any other way, bearing in mind that Wynne's definitely breaking the law, trying to blackmail a minister of the Crown out of his job."
"Are you talking about bugging Wynne's office?"
"Right in one," said Strike.
Correctly reading her dubious expression, he went on,
"Listen, by Chisel's account, Wynne's a slapdash loudmouth, which is why he's stuck in the constituency office and kept well away from his wife's work at the Department for Sport. Apparently he leaves his office door open most of the time, shouts about constituents' confidential affairs, and leaves private papers lying around in the communal kitchen. There's a good chance you'll be able to inveigle indiscretions out of him without needing the bug, but I don't think we can count on it."
Robin swilled the last of her orange juice in a glass, deliberating, then said,
"All right, I'll do it."
"Sure," said Strike. "Okay, well, you won't be able to take the voices in because you'll have to go through a metal detector. I've said I'm going to get a handful to Chisel tomorrow. He'll pass them to you once you're inside. You'll need a cover name. Text it to me when you've thought of one so I can let Chisel know. You could use Venetia Hall again, actually. Chisel's the kind of bloke who'd have a goddaughter called Venetia."
Venetia was Robin's middle name, but Robin was too full of apprehension and excitement to care that Strike, from his smirk, continued to find it amusing.
"You're going to have to work a disguise as well," said Strike. Nothing major, but Chisel remembered what you looked like from the Ripper coverage, so we've got to assume Wynne might too.
It'll be too hot for a wig, she said. I might try coloured contact lenses. I could go and buy some now. Maybe some plain-lensed glasses on top.
A smile she could not suppress surfaced again.
The House of Commons, she repeated excitedly.
Robin's excited grin faded as Sarah Shadlock's white blonde head intruded on the periphery of her vision on the other side of the bar. Sarah had just repositioned herself to keep Robin and Strike in her sights.
Let's go, Robin said to Strike.
As they walked back towards the tube, Strike explained that Barclay would be tailing Jimmy Knight.
I can't do it, said Strike regretfully. I've blown my cover with him and his corps mate.
So what will you be up to?
Plug gaps, follow up leads, cover Knights if we need 'em, said Strike.
Poor Lorelei, said Robin.
It had slipped out before she could stop herself. Increasingly heavy traffic was rolling past, and when Strike did not answer, Robin hoped that he hadn't heard her.
Did Chisel mention his son who died in Iraq?
She asked, rather like a person hastily coughing to hide a laugh that has already escaped them.
Yeah, said Strike. Freddy was clearly his favourite child, which doesn't say much for his judgment.
What do you mean?
Freddy Chisel was a prize shit. I investigated a lot of killed in actions, and I never had so many people ask me whether the dead officer had been shot in the back by his own men.
Robin looked shocked.
De mortuis nil nisi bonum, asked Strike.
Robin had learned quite a lot of Latin working with Strike.
Well, she said quietly,
for the first time finding some pity in her heart for Jasper Chisel,
you can't expect his father to speak ill of him.
They parted at the top of the street, Robin to shop for coloured contact lenses, Strike heading for the tube. He felt unusually cheerful after the conversation with Robin. As they contemplated this challenging job, the familiar contours of their friendship had suddenly resurfaced. He had liked her excitement at the prospect of entering the House of Commons, liked being the one who had offered the chance. He had even enjoyed the way she stress-tested his assumptions about Chisel's story. On the point of entering the station, Strike turned suddenly aside, infuriating the irate businessman who had been walking 6 inches in his wake. Tutting furiously, the man barely avoided a collision and strode off huffily into the underground, while the indifferent Strike leaned up against the sun-soaked wall, enjoying the sensation of heat permeating his suit jacket as he phoned Detective Inspector Eric Wardle. Strike had told Robin the truth. He didn't believe that Chisel had ever strangled a child. Yet there had been something undeniably odd about his reaction to Billy's story. Thanks to the minister's revelation that the Knight family had lived in proximity to his family home, Strike now knew that Billy had been a little kid in Oxfordshire. The first logical step in assuaging his continued unease about that pink blanket was to find out whether any children in the area had disappeared a couple of decades ago and never been found. Chapter 11. Let us stifle all memories in our sense of freedom, in joy, in passion. Henrik Ibsen, Rosmersholm. Lorelei Bevin lived in an eclectically furnished flat over her thriving vintage clothes store in Camden. Strike arrived that night at 7:30, a bottle of Pinot Noir in one hand and his mobile clamped to his ear with the other. Lorelei opened the door, smiled good-naturedly at the familiar sight of him on the phone, kissed him on the mouth, relieved him of his wine, and returned to the kitchen, from which a welcome smell of pad thai was issuing.
"Or try and get into Corps itself," Strike told Barclay, closing the door behind him and proceeding to Lorelei's sitting room, which was dominated by a large print of Warhol's Elizabeth Taylor's. "I'll send you everything I've got on Jimmy. He's involved with a couple of different groups. No idea whether he's working. His local's the White Horse in East Ham. Think he's a Hammers fan.
Could be worse, said Barclay, who was speaking quietly, as he had just got the teething baby to sleep. Could be Chelsea.
You'll have to admit to being ex-army, said Strike, sinking into an armchair and hoisting his leg up onto a conveniently positioned square poof.